Christina Benenti with your worldwide news update. An Israeli official said that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has appointed U.S.-born Ron Dermer, a close confidant, to lead negotiations for the next stage of the ceasefire with Hamas. He previously served as Israel's ambassador to the U.S. and is a former Republican activist with strong ties to the Trump White House. Israel and Hamas have yet to negotiate a second and likely more difficult phase of the ceasefire, and the first ends in early March. Palestinians and Arab countries have universally rejected U.S. President Donald Trump's proposal to remove the Palestinian population from Gaza and take over the territory. Egypt's President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi called on the international community on Wednesday during a press conference with Spain's prime minister in Madrid to adopt a plan to reconstruct war-torn Gaza without displacing Palestinians. Top U.S. and Russian officials wrapped up their meetings Tuesday in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, to discuss a pathway to end the war in Ukraine amid concerns about Ukraine's exclusion from the meeting. Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov on Wednesday praised President Trump for blaming the Ukraine conflict on moves to admit Kyiv into the NATO military alliance. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky on Wednesday responded to the meeting. Discussing their bilateral issues in Saudi Arabia is their right, although I believe that the United States of America is helping Putin to come out of years of isolation imposed absolutely fairly after the full-scale invasion. Zelensky, who dismissed claims about his approval ratings being at 4% as Russian disinformation, said Ukraine's army was resilient enough, adding that the overwhelming majority of Ukrainians would not support concessions to Russia. Russia began its full-scale invasion in February 2022 and now controls part of the Donetsk, Kherson, Luhansk, and Zaporizhia regions. It annexed the Crimea region from Ukraine in 2014. This is VOA News. Brazil's former president, Jair Bolsonaro, has been charged with attempting a coup. The plot allegedly included a plan to poison President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva and kill Supreme Court Justice Alexandre de Moraes. AP correspondent Lawrence Brooks reports.
The prosecutor general also alleges that Bolsonaro and 33 others took part in a plan to remain in power. He wrote the members of the criminal organization structured a plan at the presidential palace to attack institutions aiming to bring down systems of power and the democratic order. Bolsonaro's defense team has said it's met the accusations with dismay and indignation. A statement said the former president has never agreed to any movement aimed at deconstructing the democratic rule of law or the institutions that underpin it. I'm Lawrence Brooks.
Childhood vaccines are among the health standards that will be re-examined, according to Robert Kennedy Jr., President Trump's new health secretary. AP correspondent Ben Thomas has more.
In remarks at a welcome ceremony at the agency's headquarters, Kennedy said nothing's going to be off limits, adding that pesticides, food additives, microplastics, antidepressants, and electromagnetic waves emitted by cell phones and microwaves all would be studied. The commission's to develop a strategy around children's health within the next 6 months. Kennedy says it will investigate issues he says were formally taboo or insufficiently scrutinized. The event followed a weekend of mass firings of thousands of HHS employees, with more expected. Ben Thomas, Washington.
Faithful visiting Vatican City on Wednesday offered their prayers for Pope Francis, who is battling double pneumonia. Pearson Figuera is a tourist from Britain.
It's disappointing, really. But I believe he's strong enough to get through. I understand it's the both, but I'm sure he's going to be all right.
A Vatican official who did not wish to be named because he was not authorized to speak about the Pope's condition said on Wednesday that Francis was not on a ventilator and was breathing on his own. All of the Pope's public engagements have been canceled through Sunday. According to senior government officials, unknown gunmen shot dead 7 passengers on a Lahore-bound bus in southwestern Pakistan, Baluchistan province, after forcing them off the vehicle and checking their identity documents late on Tuesday. Baluchistan, bordering Afghanistan and Iran, is a key battleground in Pakistan's fight against separatist insurgents who want greater autonomy and a share of the region's natural resources. No group has claimed responsibility for the attack, and the motive behind the killings was unclear. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Christina Menenti, VOA News.
This is- is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
First of all, I would like to say this conference, it is representative for the rebels, representative for the dirty Sudanese people who are going to separate Sudan again after the separation of South Sudan.
That's political analyst Amar Nasir at the New Sudan Center in Germany on Sudan's paramilitary rapid support force taking a step towards forming a breakaway government. Details coming up. Also, a Ugandan judge has returned opposition politician Kizza Besigye to prison. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. South Africa will host its first major meeting as the current president of the G20 late this week. But the U.S. Secretary of State is skipping the forum's foreign ministers meeting, as Kate Bartlett reports from Johannesburg.
The chief diplomat of the world's biggest economy won't be attending a gathering of foreign ministers from the world's other large economies that starts Thursday.
I think the whole topic of the G20 gathering is one that I don't think we should be focused on, talking about global inclusion, equity, and these sorts of things.
That was U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio on February 6, explaining at a press conference why he is boycotting the foreign ministers' meeting in Johannesburg. He continued by saying the forum should be focused on issues like terrorism and energy security. Washington will likely have someone in attendance, Rubio said, but it is just not going to be him. Rubio had also posted on X, noting climate change was on the meeting's agenda and said his job was not to coddle anti-Americanism. There has been a swift deterioration in U.S.-South Africa relations under the new administration of President Donald Trump, who this month signed an executive order cutting off financial assistance to the country. The move came after he accused South Africa's government of land grabs and mistreating its white minority. The South African government says no land has been seized. Ronald Lamola, South Africa's Minister of International Relations and Cooperation, responded to Rubio's comments, noting the agenda had been adopted by all members of the G20 and carries on the themes from previous summits, like the one in Brazil last year. Here's the minister's spokesman, Crispin Fieri.
Our G20 presidency is not confined to just climate change, but also equitable treatment for nations of the global south, ensuring that we have an equal global system for all.
After Rubio pulled out of the G20 meeting, the EU expressed its support for South Africa, as did several European ambassadors to the country in a video message, including Italy's envoy, Alberto Vecchi.
Like you, we are committed to multilateralism, rule-based international order, and more equity and justice in the world.
U.S. rival China also expressed support for South Africa's G20 presidency, and its top envoy, Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi, is expected to attend the event in Johannesburg this week. Russia likewise reaffirmed its commitment to the process, saying Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov would be present at the meeting. Some political analysts told VOA Rubio's absence could provide space for countries hostile to the U.S. to advance their agendas. Here's Stephen Grust from the South African Institute of International Affairs.
Will we see the increase of countries like Russia and China pushing their lines, their issues, their perspectives in the absence of the U.S.? That's entirely possible.
On Monday, Minister Lamola confirmed Washington would have someone at the foreign ministers' meeting in Rubio's absence, though they said they did not have a name yet. Top U.S. officials, including Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, would also be present at a G20 finance ministers' meeting in Cape Town later this month, Lamola said. In November, South Africa hosts the main G20 summit, after which it hands over the revolving presidency of the group to the U.S. It is not yet clear whether President Trump will attend. Kate Bartlett, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Some experts say China's scaling back of financial support for infrastructure construction in Africa opens the door for the United States and Western Europe to fill the void. But they say the question is whether the United States has desire to take advantage of the opportunity. Paul Nanatulia, a research associate at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, discussed that with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
It's difficult to say with any level of certainty what that relationship will look like and, you know, how African countries will respond. But I think it's important to look at it from an African stakeholder perspective. African stakeholders have got a bad experience with the continent being pulled into geopolitical blocks. There are memories of the Cold War and the alliances that African countries had to, you know, you were either pro-East or pro-West, and, you know, that came with a whole range of things, which even stalled the democratic project and the democratic process in Africa. And so the burst of energy of democratization that we saw in the 1990s was part of that resistance to the idea that African countries should be pulled into geopolitical blocks. So those memories are fresh. And the Africans that have come of age, you know, in their mid-40s, in their early 50s, the people that are actually now in the private sector, and in positions of influence, thought leaders lived through the Cold War and would not want to see a repeat of a situation where you have major powers that are conducting themselves in a way that leans heavily on African countries to choose one side or the other. So when we look at it from an African perspective, what African stakeholders want to see is they want to see their governments, and I think even governments as well, you know, when you talk to African diplomats, the refrain will always be African countries diplomatically want to have the freedom and the latitude to work with partners across the board. So that means working with United States, working with China, working with Scandinavian countries, working with Latin American countries, working with Southeast Asia, working with the Middle East. There is an African within, I call it the African diplomatic DNA, which is really fixated on the idea that Africa should diversify its international partnerships. So whenever I get the question about great power competition or strategic competition, I always like to reverse it. And if I may, to articulate it, but from an African perspective. And from an African perspective, it looks very different. Africans do not want to be pulled into geopolitical blocks, but at the same time, they want to work with partners across the board in order to increase strategic choices that are available to African countries.
So what are the top objectives on the African agenda for relations with China in 2025?
Four top issues. One is value addition. There are quite a number of African countries that have already passed laws, or there's legislation in the works that is explicitly forbidding the export of unprocessed goods, unprocessed minerals, in order to pressure international partners, and that would also cover China, from simply taking out raw materials. Connected to that is market access. So China, you know, in September, there was a new initiative that has been put in place that allows African countries to export, I think it's 120 products into the Chinese markets duty-free. But you see, you still have non-tariff barriers in place, which African countries have been raising with the Chinese. So this is going to be, I think you're going to see African countries really pushing very hard on this. The other element is infrastructure. So African countries want to diversify and want to multiply their sources of infrastructure finance. And I think this is something that African countries are going to continue pushing the Chinese side on. The other element is how to manage debt, issues of debt sustainability. And we have seen African professional groups. There's a group called Development Reimagined that has been working very, very hard with the African multilateral financial institutions like the African Development Bank to look at these institutions as channels of infrastructure finance. And that can go a long way in solving the problem of debt sustainability. The other critically important issue is co-financing. So for instance, the African Development Bank does have a number of co-financing arrangements with Chinese policy banks in a number of areas, including infrastructure, including energy, and so on. So, Mohammed, I think these are the four strategic issues that African countries are going to be pushing for over the next 3 years. The next summit is in 2027, and the two sides have committed themselves to a number of commitments. But it's important having a tracking system to monitor these commitments, to monitor the implementation of the FOCAC program, and to hold Chinese and African governments accountable. I think that is also going to be a very key issue. And that is pressure that is coming from the African private sector and from the exponential growth of independent China-Africa knowledge networks that have sprouted over the last 5 to 10 years.
That was Paul Nanatulia, a research associate at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies here in Washington, speaking with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shinawi. A Ugandan judge has returned opposition politician Kizza Besigye to prison despite his frail health. His wife has accused the government of using the courts to suppress opponents. Reporter Mugume Davis Rwakaringi has more from Kampala.
High Court Judge Douglas Karikona Sinjiza deferred a request to release opposition leader Kizza Besigye no later than February 25th to the shock of his family and opposition supporters. Besigye looked visibly unwell, just as he did last week when he appeared at a different hearing. The judge said he was in two courts happy to have seen Besigye in court, but ordered his immediate return to prison for health reasons. Speaking after Wednesday's hearing, Besigye's wife Winnie Byanyima said she did not expect a fair hearing before what she called in two courts a cadre judge who stands for honoring the interests of the government and President Museveni.
I came here expecting to take Dr. Kizza Besigye home today. I'm devastated, but I'm not surprised. Museveni has put all of us in captivity. This cadre judge, shame on him. Shame on him to send back to jail a man whose health is deteriorating very fast.
Doctors have warned Besigye is becoming weaker and asked the government to release him so he can access better medical facilities. Besigye is also on a hunger strike. Besigye was kidnapped by the government from Kenya's capital Nairobi in November and presented before a military court in Uganda on charges of planning to destabilize national security. Last month, the Supreme Court ruled that trying civilians in military courts is illegal and asked that cases be immediately transferred to ordinary courts. Opposition leader Robert Chagurani, commonly known as Bobi Wine, also criticized the judge's decision.
This is a regime persecuting Dr. Besigye and all other political prisoners in the name of prosecution. We are not going to stop. We gave the regime 48 hours to release Dr. Kizza Besigye because we want him alive. They are trying to kill him, and all of you see.
Without going into details, Bobi Wine said the opposition will continue to pressure the government to ensure that Besigye is released. Elias Rukwago is Besigye's lawyer. He says the judge should have been more compassionate due to Besigye's declining health.
It's really baffling because at least if he was not in position to give the judgment today, probably would have indicated that give me today or tomorrow, then I'll deliver the ruling within the course of tomorrow or the day after tomorrow.
Besigye has on four occasions and successfully run for president. He was formerly Museveni's personal physician and ally during the guerrilla war, which brought Museveni to power. On Tuesday, Museveni posted on social media X that the state is working on files to be transferred to the ordinary courts. Museveni is opposed to the Supreme Court ruling that quashed the trial of civilians in military courts. He says those calling for Besigye's release are promoting insecurity. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakaringi in Kampala, Uganda.
A military official says Ugandan troops have entered the city of Bunia in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo to help local forces stop deadly violence by armed groups. The Associated Press reports that a meeting Monday between Ugandan forces and Congolese troops in Bunia, the capital of Ituri province, agreed on a joint deployment in the city, where the Ugandan military spokesman says killings along ethnic lines have escalated. A military spokesman says Ugandan forces now control Bunia together with DRC forces, he said, asserting that the action was provoked by crimes including killings. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Find us on voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. You can share your thoughts about the news and our programs by WhatsApp. The number is +1 202 258 3076. We'll be sharing our listeners' comments on Africa News Tonight. We'd like to take a moment here to remember a longtime VOA colleague, Lisa Schlein, who passed away a few days ago in Geneva. Many of you, you listening to our program, knew Lisa as a dedicated journalist covering the United Nations. She brought news about the UN, the World Health Organization, UNICEF, the World Food Program, and many other agencies to people around the world. Lisa reported for VOA from Geneva for more than three decades. We at VOA will miss her professionalism, her dedication, and her friendship. The Rapid Support Forces, the paramilitary group battling for power in Sudan's civil war, took a step towards forming a breakaway government on Tuesday when it hosted a lavish political event in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. To get a better perspective on the matter, I talked with activist and political analyst Amar Nasir at the New Sudan Center under the Umbuja organization in Germany.
First of all, I would like to say this conference, it is representative for the rebels, representative for the dirty Sudanese people who are going to separate Sudan again after the separation of South Sudan. Working to separate North Sudan under umbrella for Amarat and other countries. This is the real objective for this conference. Their aims to separate Sudan. They start in Khartoum 15 April by force. They need to capture the authority in Sudan by force. The Sudanese people support the army, support the unity of the Sudan. Also, the Kurdufan, South Kurdufan, Nuba Mountain, North Kurdufan, all of them support the unity of Sudan. Darfurian people support the unity of Sudan. And then they're going to play this game to reflect. They're looking for the right of the Darfurian people or the marginalized people. Second thing, this country, Kenyan and South Sudan and Chad, this country, they playing dirty game against the Sudan. They don't respect the Sudanese government. They don't respect the Sudanese people's idea about this war. Majority of the Sudanese people support this government. Those countries, they are not respect the Sudanese idea. That is why they're going to give pass for the Janjaweed to make their conference there. This is also a big mistake. Kenyan government make it and South Sudan government make it. There is no future for the relationship with the Sudan if they make this conference and they create this government, outside government, in their land. That is why they're facing the risk, diplomatic risk, and then they stop the procedures for this government.
And basically you're saying the RSF is actually advocating for the partition of Sudan.
They are going to separate the North Sudan. Before Sudan separate through the self-determination, through the legal way, within the comprehensive peace agreement between SPLM and government of Sudan. This is normal situation. But the North Sudan now, they want to divide the North Sudan now. They want to make a government in Darfur. They want to make like the Libyan. They want to distribute Sudan to the area for the economic resource just to the Amarat and other countries to eat for our resource. This is only their aims.
And why is Kenya involved in this? Why the meeting in Kenya, in Nairobi?
The meeting in Kenya, in Nairobi, the president for Kenya, Ruto, have a relationship with Amarat. And Amarat is a country give, protect, and support the RSF. That is why now you look the Amarat going to make a mobilization to make a conference in African Union. But the African Union leaders tension about the risk of this conference and they refuse. Amarat play in Kenya, play in South Sudan, play in Chad, play in all the country neighbor Sudan. They want by force to give RSF in government in Sudan. They feel they want to make another government in Darfur. That is why they use, they pay. When the war started in Sudan, 15 April 2023, a lot of leaders take the money for Sudan, for RSF, go to stay in Kenya. We looking how the first conference by Gadumbay Hamdok is done there. A lot of activities. Kenya is good place for the rebel, for the SPLM, Al-Hilu, for the, those people against the government of Sudan. They're working there.
Political analyst Amar Nasir at the New Sudan Center, he spoke to me from Germany. 14-year-old Gesma fled Sudan's Darfur region after armed militias killed her parents and brother, leaving her to care for her youngest siblings. Now living in a refugee camp in Chad, she works long hours to keep her family fed, a reality faced by many children displaced by brutal violence in Darfur. Henry Wilkins reports.
14-year-old Gesma arrived in this refugee camp on Chad's border with Sudan's Darfur region 2 years ago. She says she fled Darfur after ethnic Arab militias killed her mother, father, and brother. VOA is withholding her last name to protect her identity.
They killed my little brother. After that, they caught me and then released me. I saw a lot of dead people when we were traveling along the road.
She made the journey to Chad with only her younger siblings and her stepfather. Now she works in kitchens and waitresses at a restaurant here in the town of Adre.
I wash clothes and clean furniture too. This is my work. The money I earn, I give to my family so we can buy food.
She says she is the sole breadwinner for the family, including her stepfather, who is unemployed. Social workers in Adre told VOA that teenage girls like Gesma, who work at local night spots, are often subject to abuse by their employers and customers. UNICEF, the UN's children's agency, says child labour in Adre is a major problem. Francesca Casato is UNICEF's chief of child protection in Chad.
It's very difficult to have a clear statistics on this. But it is an issue. It is a big issue.
Many children can be seen making mud bricks and working in markets all over Adre. Casato says that if they're working, they're not only exposing themselves to potential danger, but are also missing out on their education and perhaps most importantly, their childhoods. She says children who arrive with no caregivers are especially vulnerable to exploitation.
So children who arrived either completely alone, so with no care, without caregivers, like without parents or without any other relative, and those are the most vulnerable because they really arrived alone.
Gesma says she just wants things to go back to the way they were in Darfur, when she used to hang out with her friends.
My friends were killed. There were three of them. I used to go to school with them.
With so many of those she loved gone and the responsibility of providing for her younger siblings, there is little hope for a return to normality. Henry Wilkins, VOA News, Adre, Chad.
Uganda's health minister today said 8 patients treated for Ebola in Uganda have recovered and declared the country's latest outbreak of the deadly disease contained. Health Minister Jane Ruth Ikenga said the patients had been discharged on Tuesday and Wednesday from a hospital in Kampala. Uganda has confirmed 9 cases overall in the latest outbreak, including a nurse who died from the disease in the capital Kampala in January. Keng said 265 other people remained under quarantine for monitoring after coming into contact with the patient who died. It's the 6th time the East African nation has been hit by the Ebola Sudan species of the virus, for which there is no approved vaccine. A vaccination trial for the strain was launched in the country earlier this month. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Douglas Mpuga, and our engineer, Adrias Rigas, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.